How to Survive the Ice Age. Let's say you want to visit the era when glaciers taller than skyscrapers covered Canada, Scandinavia, and Northern Europe. You want to live side by side with humans, hyenas, bears, wolves, reindeer, woolly rhinoceroses, mammoths, and lions. You want to see if you can survive in one of the coldest places on Earth during one of the coldest periods in human history. So you travel back 25,000 years to see springtime in the vast, frigid mammoth steppe of what is now Eastern Europe. You'll see the mighty glaciers. You'll shiver beneath the mile-high walls of ice. You'll cower in front of the prowling leopards and stalking cheetahs. And then, a few hours after your arrival, you'll feel the first pangs of hunger. Unfortunately, here on these high, dry plains, archaeological evidence suggests an extraordinarily limited menu. In the refuse pile of one human camp, mammoths comprise 98% of all bones found. The bad news, then, is that if you want to eat here on the steppe, you'll have to pursue the most dangerous prey humans have ever hunted, the great woolly mammoth. Mammoths were so dangerous that it wasn't until recently that archaeologists became convinced humans ever pursued them. Many scholars suspected that Stone Age hunters scavenged the mammoths found in their camps rather than hunted them, but the mammoths' ages at the times of their deaths suggest hunter selection rather than natural demise, and paleoarchaeologist Piotr Voytal removed any doubt when he found a smoking gun, a 24,000-year-old flint arrowhead still lodged deep in a mammoth's rib. The evidence is by now unequivocal. Stone Age steppe cultures not only hunted mammoths, they did so to near exclusion. In modern times, the great woolly mammoth's close and similarly sized relative, the 6-ton African elephant, occasionally kills poachers armed with guns. You'll have stick and stone. Nevertheless, as you grow hungry on the cold steppe, you may have only one option. Launch a small stick with a sharpened rock point at a minibus-sized animal armed with twin 8-foot-long ivory spears. And yet, even before you earn the privilege of placing yourself near the business end of the pissed-off 6-ton creature, you'll have to survive in a climate that is far different and, in many ways, far more punishing than anything you could possibly experience in the modern world. Colloquially, the era in which you find yourself is referred to as the Ice Age, but that's a confusing misnomer, says Nicholas Swanson Heisel, a professor of Earth and Planetary Science at UC Berkeley, because we are still living through the very same Ice Age. It began almost 3 million years ago when carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere first began to plummet. Carbon dioxide in the atmosphere serves as our planet's insulation. It traps heat otherwise headed for deep space, so its quantity dictates the Earth's temperature. In eras when it has been elevated, such as in the Triassic, when its atmospheric concentration soared to 2,000 parts per million, you could have bathed above the Arctic Circle on a fern-forested beach. And when carbon has dropped, such as in the Cryogenian, when it plunged below 40 parts per million, ice has encrusted the equator. Footnote. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, the atmosphere contained 278 parts per million of carbon dioxide. Today, it is up to 417 parts per million, which is a level that throughout history has corresponded with no permanent northern ice sheets. That there still are ice sheets is simply because carbon levels have risen incredibly quickly, and the temperature is still catching up. Right now, Earth is like a bag of frozen peas sitting in a freezer after the plug has just been pulled. The planet will thaw, but it will take some time. Because rocks contain the vast majority of the Earth's carbon, prior to the Industrial Revolution, only volcanism spewed the significant planet-warming amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. At the end of the Triassic, for example, a 500-year eruption released 1 million cubic miles of lava and vented as much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as all human activity in the 21st century. The planet warmed by 5 degrees, and 3/4 of the world's species died. But just as carbon enters the atmosphere with the destruction of rocks, it also exits with their creation. When carbon dioxide dissolves into water and encounters calcium and magnesium from freshly eroded mafic rock, the minerals and carbon react in a process called weathering and settle on the ocean floor as vast beds of limestone. In other words, the life cycle of carbon looks something like this. Rocks, volcano, air, ocean, rocks. Volcanic eruptions might be more dramatic than the rather mundane chemical reaction that creates limestone, but the process has an equally profound, if diametrically opposed, environmental effect. When inordinate quantities of fresh mafic rock erode into water, the rock's minerals react with the atmosphere's carbon to create huge limestone beds. Earth loses its insulation, and the planet enters an ice age. Of course, an increase in erosion sufficient to lock up enough carbon to send the planet into a prolonged freeze doesn't occur with the occasional mudslide. It occurs with the creation and erosion of entirely new islands and new mountain ranges. It occurs when continents and volcanic arcs collide and uplift huge amounts of fresh rock loaded with calcium and magnesium. And even then, only when those mountain ranges arise in the warmest, wettest, most erosion-friendly places. In other words, ice ages have an inciting incident, and it is always the same, a tectonic collision in the tropics. 3 million years ago, the Indonesian archipelago slammed into northern Australia. Millions of tons of fresh mafic rock uplifted into torrents of warm rain. Calcium and magnesium flowed into the ocean, locked away gigatons of carbon into beds of limestone, and the Earth's temperature plunged. Footnote: the beautiful balance in this cycle, which keeps Earth's climate from swerving too far beyond an equilibrium, is that the chemical weathering process that sequesters carbon in rocks happens more efficiently in heat. So the warmer the planet becomes, the more carbon is removed, and vice versa. For this reason, Swanson Heisel tells me, the Earth will eventually remove the excess carbon we're emitting into the atmosphere. The bad news is that this process takes a few 100,000 years. So the planet will eventually be fine. The fate of humanity is far less clear. Yet even within ice ages, the Earth warms and cools as a result of cyclical changes in its orbit. Like a spinning top, the planet wobbles ever so slightly as it spins. These wobbles occur on 40,000-year cycles, and as Earth increases its tilt, its hemispheres receive less winter sun, altering the ocean's currents in ways that cause the sea to sequester more carbon. The northern hemisphere reached the nadir of its wobble 25,000 years ago, causing atmospheric carbon dioxide to plummet to 65% of pre-industrial levels, and the average global temperature plunged 15 degrees below what it is today. With the Earth's insulation ripped away, massive ice sheets covered much of its northern hemisphere. As you look around this new world of ice you have arrived in and try to understand the environment, your tendency might be to take what you already know about the current European steppe and drop the temperature 15 degrees. That simple formula would suggest you found yourself in an Arctic tundra like those of modern northern Canada or Russia. But both examples are wrong, as is your attempt to liken your current environment to anything you would find on Earth today. This is a tricky cognitive pitfall to avoid. Unlike in the dinosaur age, many animals will be familiar to you, but they'll appear in what seems like a bizarre biological juxtaposition. You'll see what you thought were animals that lived only in the African savanna grazing next to Arctic ones. You'll observe Arctic fox, bison, and reindeer, and all will seem normal, but then you'll watch a cheetah chase them. A rhino may graze next to a wolverine. A wolf may sit beside a lion. The result is an unsettlingly familiar landscape that falls into a kind of biological uncanny valley. If you spot a pack of lions racing after a reindeer, do not be alarmed. Well, maybe you should be alarmed, but at least you're not imagining things. Instead of comparing where you are to what you know, start with this. You're in a cold, arid environment filled with sunny days and very little clouds or rain. Yearly rainfall approaches desert levels thanks to the Scandinavian ice sheets deflecting moisture from the Atlantic. Yet these same glaciers produce soil with fantastically productive potential thanks to constant replenishing from glacial deposits. The result is an incredible faunal dichotomy between the watered river valleys and the desert dry highlands in the Mammoth Steppe. The elevated plateaus and mountain terraces resemble polar deserts, while the watered soil of the river valleys explode in productivity. The floodplains of the Mammoth Steppe's rich soils create an ideal grazing environment for the large nomadic herd animals such as bison, horses, woolly mammoths, as well as the big game hunters capable of bringing them down. These include wolves, lions, cheetahs, and, of course, humans. The people you see here are members of what archaeologists now call the Pavlovian culture. You'll find their camps located above river valleys where people can look out over vast grasslands, observe the mammoth herds that graze on them, and plan their hunts. Mammoth hunting is not a solo pursuit, which means that as you hunger, you'll need to make friends. But that may not be as hard as you might think. In popular culture, the Pavlovians are often depicted with large clubs, tiger skins, and a general oafishness. But among archaeologists, they're renowned for their sophisticated clothing, artwork, and intricate ivory bone carvings of voluptuous female figures, known as Venus figurines. Fortunately for you, the expert view provides a far more accurate portrayal than the popular one. Cognitively, the Pavlovians are an entirely modern group of Homo sapiens who are at least as smart as you, and certainly smarter in regard to everything that matters here. They have wildly different religious beliefs and different customs than you, but they do have religious beliefs, and they do have customs. Like all other people, they argue, joke, gossip, laugh, love, fight, make jewelry, paint beautifully, smile when they're happy, scowl when they're upset, sing, play music, and probably dance to it. They pray, tease, fight, play, coordinate sophisticated hunts, and surely have societal rules and norms as varied and complex as those of modern cultures. They're also remarkably tall. And not just for their era, but for any era. The men average just over 6 feet in height, equal to the average height in the tallest country in the world today. They have brown eyes and dark skin that they protect from the average winter temperatures of -4 degrees Fahrenheit, with sophisticated, parka-like clothing composed of furs from local Arctic foxes, wolves, and wolverines, which they catch using fiber nets and traps. Because there are few trees or wood here of any kind, they burn bones for their fires. If you want to survive this cold and metabolically expensive lifestyle, then you, like them, need a meal high in protein and fats. Where you are, that means mammoths. When you get hungry, it's that or starve. To hunt mammoths, you need to first craft a spear with a shaft made of wood or bone and a spearhead of chipped flint. You might think you should throw this spear. Don't. Your target is a 6-ton animal with an inch-thick hide. The spear will merely anger it and you will die. Instead, you need to build a spear thrower. A spear thrower, also called an atlatl, is a short, flat stick with a spear-holding hook on one end and a handle on the other. Its simple design belies a deadly effect. By adding another lever to your throwing motion, the spear thrower turns your mammoth tickler into a formidable weapon. An experienced thrower can use an atlatl to launch a spear at over 100 miles per hour. The atlatl launch flint spearhead, Voital found in the mammoth rib, traveled through 4 inches of the animal's skin and fat and then penetrated deep into its bone. After crafting your spear and atlatl, you need to choose your camp. A hillside above a river valley where you can observe approaching mammoth herds is a necessity. But ideally, this river valley should also lead into a natural trap. The Pavlovian site in southern Poland, where Wojtal discovered the flint spear buried in the mammoth rib, is on a rocky promontory overlooking a natural cul-de-sac. The area was a kind of trap, he explains, isolated from 3 sides, from the north by a rocky cliff, and from the east and west by depressions and gorges. You need to find a site like this. A place where you can drive a single mammoth into a dead end so you have a chance to face it. Choosing your target is also critical. Skeletal remains suggest even the mammoth hunting specialists rarely attacked old bulls, even though these bulls likely traveled alone. The reason for this is obvious. Old males are large and highly aggressive, particularly if they are in must, a period of heightened aggression in bull elephants when they're liable to attack everything from birds and giraffes to even trees. Rather than being shooed into a trap, a bull in must may simply charge. When I asked Wojtal how he would recommend taking down a mammoth, he suggested the approach of the people at the Kraków Spadzista site he studied. Isolate a mammoth from a group, perhaps one that seems weak or wounded, and herd it into the cul-de-sac. Once there, the game is simple. It was man against mammoth, says Wojtal. There's no evidence the Pavlovians at Kraków Spadzista ran mammoths over cliffs or used ropes or underground pits or dogs. In fact, there's a great deal of evidence they did not. Rather, Wojtal tells me, the fight was as basic as it was brutal. A furious animal with weight from 1 to 6 tons on one side and a hunter with a stick on the opposite, he explains. From the angle of the flint entry wound on the mammoth skeleton he found, Wojtal believes hunters faced the mammoth head-on and launched their spears in quick succession. It may seem dangerous to fire at the business end of a 6-ton creature, and it is, but unfortunately, you don't have a choice. Mammoth rears, like elephants, were virtually impenetrable. There's no use, and in fact, it would be extremely ill-advised to fire at a mammoth when its back is turned. It's the mammoth-hunting equivalent of blindsiding a bully with a spitball. You need to do more damage. You need to face the mammoth, and if you want the spear to carry enough velocity on impact, you need to be uncomfortably close. In other words, the best plan is to launch a weapon that by itself stands very little chance of disabling the animal and a very high chance of angering it from a very close range. Wojtal tells me it's unknown how frequently the Pavlovian hunters died hunting mammoths. Archaeologists haven't found nearly enough Pavlovian skeletons to draw any general conclusions, but he assures me your hunt won't be safe. If the spear hits, a full-grown 6-ton mammoth may charge you at 20 miles per hour with lethal intent. Should you run, fight, or play dead? According to the 19th-century Scottish big game hunter Walter Bell's 1923 memoir, The Wanderings of an Elephant Hunter, no advice in this scenario is useful. An elephant's charge is a nerve test of the highest order, he writes. Bell, who began his career at age 16 hunting man-eating lions for the Ugandan Railway, writes that an elephant's charge is so terrifying that any instructions he conveys to his readers are probably useless, as you won't have time to think of anything anyway. However, if you don't panic when the great mammoth charges, he suggests you stand your ground, continue to fire, and hope the charge is a false one. You can take Bell's advice. You can stand and throw, but Bell had a gun. You have stick and stone. I have never hunted man-eating lions, but I think you should run. Of course, don't run in a straight line. The mammoth is faster than you and thus will catch you in seconds. Instead, run below your top speed in the same zigzag pattern that saved you from the Tyrannosaurus Rex. The mammoth is about as large as a Tyrannosaurus, but not nearly as mobile, so turn frequently and find something to hide behind. Though, keep in mind, the mammoth can easily topple trees or move car-sized boulders. If the mammoth runs you down, it will probably attempt to gore you with its tusks. Failing that, it will finish the job by stomping you. And here, where you are, an injury of any severity will be a fatal one. But you can avoid this fate. Possibly. Just attack in a group. Avoid large mammoth herds and single aggressive males. Launch your spears in quick succession while facing the mammoth. Hope it charges someone else in your group. And if you happen to be the unlucky one, run.